So this text called Bhakti Sudha or Nectar of Devotion talks about love. Our idea of love is hold on to a particular object or a person. But this talks about divine love or the supreme love or the love for God who is the supreme, and how love for Him makes us unselfish, reduces our ego. And then last week we had talked about the nature of God, because some people think of God as being a tyrant or an emperor sitting up there watching us suffer, or some people think of Him as a giver of things. Give me this, give me that. Or other people think of Him as a judge who just loves to punish and throw people into hell. But we studied last week that He is actually the self of all beings. He is my true nature and the substratum, the support of all. Just as the ocean is the god of all the waves, the gold is the god of all the ornaments. So similarly is our relationship with God. We are not separate from Him. We are not far from Him. It is just our ignorance that separates us from Him. So today's subject is the difference between attachment and devotion. What is attachment and what is devotion, and how one brings us down? That's why I have it in black, and the other one takes us up. So we shall study that today in verse number 9, which talks about attachment to one's object. What does it do to us, and why it is harmful in our spiritual journey?
Vishayaikasthita sakti hi dharma vijnana nashini anarthakarini hesha. Heya shreyorthi bhi sadha.
So, vishaya eka sthita sakti. Vishaya means one object. Eka means one object, sthiti, established in one object or stationed in one object, asakti, attachment. What happens when you love just one object or one person or one thing more than anything else? Dharma vijnana nashini. It destroys dharma. Dharma means all that is good, all that is righteous, all that is my duty. Dharma means my duty. What is good for all I'm supposed to do, it destroys that. And vijnana, and it destroys my intellect. It destroys my ability to think, my ability to discriminate, my ability to decide is all destroyed when I get excessively attached to one object. It could be a person, could be a job, could be a situation, could be a thing. And what does it do, this attachment? Anarthakarini. Anartha means it brings calamities in our life. Once you get so attached, your life becomes full of calamities. Hesha, this attachment. Therefore, heya, therefore it should be given up by shreyo arthi bhi sada. Shreya. Shreya means good. So one who is pursuing the path of goodness, sada, should always give up attachment. So I thought I would talk a little bit about Shreya and Preya, which is covered in a lot of our scriptures. The Kathopanishad, which you are studying on Tuesday, talks about this in detail. Shreya means that which is good for me, and Preya means that which is pleasant, which gives me pleasure. And instinctively, we always want to choose that. What gives me happiness, what gives me pleasure, what I enjoy, what gives me fun, but what is good for me, we like to put it off. It's like exercise. Now, exercise is good for me, I know that. But I choose the path of least resistance. I get up in the morning, today it's too hot, you know, to go to the gym. And then today it's too cold. It's too dark. You know, we always look for excuses. And gym, when we go, you know, you're tired and you are sweating. And you know, you are, you know, it's hot and your body aches and you are sore. But the thing about the prayer, Shreya, is that in the long run, this gives you good. It's good, like going to the gym, doing exercise, eating healthy. In the beginning, you might think, oh, I am depriving myself of pizza and ice cream and, you know, all the fun foods. And maybe I'm eating more healthy. But in the long run, this leads to good. And the path of pleasure, you know, where, say, I don't exercise, I eat unhealthy, then in the long run, it leads to suffering. I get ill health, So it is in any field. Anytime when you choose the path of pleasure over the path of good, it does not mean that one should not enjoy life. But when the enjoyment becomes excessive in the form of dependence and the goodness is given up, when I know something is good for me and I still do not do it, then that's why it says in the beginning it seems difficult, but in the long run it gives you good. While this one in the beginning seems very pleasant, but in the long run the consequences are bad. So when I get dependent on a particular object, like it says, it is called attachment, where this becomes my whole life. Without this person or without this thing, I just cannot live. Life is not worth living. Some people get addicted to alcohol or drugs, where they will do anything to get it. Some people do their job, you know, they become workaholics, where all they think of from morning to night is a job, and the family is missing them, children, wife, it doesn't matter. Money, you know, money is such a big addiction. Money is useful, it is good to function, but when money becomes an addiction, then it makes you blind. So attachment for anything. Once I get attached to something, then I don't see anything else than to possess that, how many people I have to hurt, and I don't see right or wrong, I don't see good or bad, I'm just focused on that object and that object alone, and I don't see the welfare of anybody else, because I and me alone, it makes me very blind. While a person who has devotion or love for God, her perception is very clear. Why? Because when I love God and I fill my heart with those divine qualities of love and compassion, then my heart becomes pure. And in a pure heart, in a pure mind, where there is love and compassion and absence of greed, absence of jealousy, absence of hatred, then in such a mind which is calm, which is peaceful, that's why after you go to the church or temple, or after you have meditated, or after you have read some good books or listened to some good music, your mind is so calm and so peaceful, and that is when creativity arises. If you ask great authors or writers like Dr. Betty, he writes books, I'm sure he'll tell you that when he's upset or agitated or very, very busy, the mind cannot create. For the mind to create, it has to be calm, it has to be peaceful. And in such a mind, all good things arise. So that's why it says it makes his perception clear. The person develops a true appreciation of what is important, what is not important in life. So that understanding comes when one attaches to God. Then attachment to an object is changing. Like, you know, it could be anything. Like a person gets, I'm tired of my job, he'll change his job. Or it changed his spouse, or changed his city. You know, I'm tired of living in Bakersfield. It's so hot. I'm going to move to the coast. Maybe I'll find happiness there. Or they'll change the state, change their house. So they'll change. Or the same object that used to give me joy, things were so nice, you know, in the beginning. And now it's boring. You know, the same thing, the same activity. I used to love skiing, and some people go every weekend, and after a while they are so bored of it, you know, they just don't. So that it can be changing from object to object, or to that same object itself, the attachment changes, while attachment or the love for God is permanent, does not change, because in fact, if at all, it grows, it never gets less. Why? Because he's all complete, he's all perfect, he's permanent. And when I hold on to the permanent And when I hold on to the perfect, when I hold on to the complete, then slowly, slowly my heart also gets filled with those same divine qualities of love and compassion and completeness and perfection. Because what you think, you become. The more you think of something, just as a basketball player, all day he's watching videos of Magic and Michael, a physicist is reading about the lives of, you know, Oppenheimer and Einstein. A spiritual person reads the lives of saints. Why? Because saints were the ones who loved God. And through, that's why they say that one of the best literature you can read is just read the lives of great saints. Saints of the East, saints of the West. And the more you read, it is so enchanting. It is so uplifting. You know, there are movies you can watch. So just spend some time, just, and you may think, what am I going to gain about the life of somebody who died 500 years ago or 1,000 years ago? But when you see the love they had for God and how they were able to withstand all the life's sorrows, so it is permanent, it is uplifting. Devotion is, attachment is exclusive. That alone I think of, that alone I want. And I don't care for anything else and everybody else, but devotion for God is all-inclusive. We have studied last week also, because God is my nature. He's myself. He's the substratum. I am made up of that. And not only I am, but he, she, all, everybody is made of that, even the chair, even the floor. So a true devotee of God cannot hate anyone. Truly loves all, not only living beings, but animals and plants and birds and fish and even inanimate objects. He has love because he even won't mistreat his shoes or his car or his, you know, his dog or cat. All inclusive, total love for all. Attachment brings me down. Why? Because when I'm attached to something, I want to possess it. I want to acquire it, and then when I don't get it, I get angry, and then I get jealous of somebody who has more, and then I become very possessive and exclusive, and then it brings me down. I become very demanding. I become very selfish. I become very arrogant if I have it. So it brings us down. Why? Devotion uplifts us, because as I said, he is all complete, and the more I get attached to that love, and that, the more my mind gets uplifted. That's why when you get up in the morning and meditate for a while, or when you just stand on the east and just watch the beautiful sun rising, or the moon was up the last few days, you see the Lord's beautiful glory. Today the sunrise was so pretty. It was orange, and you know, it was so beautiful. So your mind automatically gets uplifted. Automatically you think of that one divine Lord. So attachment brings us down. Devotion uplifts us. Attachment only wants gratification. What can I get out of it? And I want it, and I want to possess it, and I want to enjoy it, and I want more and more and more. It's never satisfied. Person who is attached is never satisfied. No matter how much he or she gets, whether it's money, whether it's power. They say power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And that's why we find when there are dictators or kings, their whole life was, you know, full of corruption. But a true devotee shares. Because nothing belongs to me. Everything is his. Whatever I have has been given by him to me. So even when I go and offer a candle or a flower into the church or the temple, or even if I give money and all, I think I am giving so much to God, I am doing so much. Whatever, it's like you have taken from his garden the flower and offered it to him, or whatever the possessions you have been given by him to you. And if you give them to him, nothing belongs to us. So that attitude, that everything belongs to the Lord, and whenever I help anybody, I am sharing with the Lord's beings. Devotion is attachment. It is because I can get something from somebody, that's why I'm attached. Like this girl asked this boy, you know, her beloved, her boyfriend, she says her father had just given her $1 million, you know, in the trust fund. So she says, you know, honey, do you love me because my father just gave me $1 million? He said, darling, what are you talking? It's not true at all. I would love you the same no matter who gave you $1 million. Attachment is because of something. And a devotee continues to love God in spite of whatever happens in his or her life. Even the biggest sorrows may come. Why is that? Why? Because the person never stops loving God, no matter how many problems, no matter how many sorrows, no matter how many. Because the true devotee understands that my sorrows are not caused by God, who is standing down there and watching me suffer and throwing, you know, sorrows at me. They are because of my own karmas, because of my own actions that I am getting them. Or he sees every sorrowful situation as an opportunity to grow. And the true devotee, and if you truly look at it in your life, whenever sorrowful or problem situations came, it was meant for you to grow out of. And if you take that situation as a challenge, as an opportunity to grow, then you will realize that there is a divine doctor who is sitting up there, and whatever I need at the time for my growth, he provides. So in spite of any problems, the devotee never loses his faith in God. Attachment creates agitation, because when I want something, I want it, and then my mind is not at rest till I get it, agitated and disturbed and angry. And this reminds me of the story of Helen of Troy. Some people say it's a myth. Some people say it was a true incident, which Homer then put in his Iliad and kind of added to it. But it's a beautiful story. It's very long, but I'll just summarize it. I think some of you may have read it. But Helen was supposed to be the most beautiful girl at that time. And there was nobody as beautiful as her. And she was married to this Greek king. And he loved her and all. And so they were living very happily. And this king had a friend named Paris, who was a very handsome young man. And so Paris comes to visit them and stays with them for a few weeks, you know, and months. And so it happens that Helen falls in love with Paris, you know, with her husband's friend. And her husband, the king, had to go for some battle or some, you know, some things, problems happening in other part of the kingdom. So he's gone for a few months, and they fall in love, and they decide to escape, you know, to elope. And so she has a few warriors who are loyal to her. And so they take those warriors and they get a couple of ships and they take off, you know, and they go to his kingdom, where he was a prince of, or a royal person in the kingdom of Troy. So they go there in the boat and they go and live there. And when the king comes back, he's furious because his wife took off with his friend. So he says, I must go and get her. And he finds out that Paris, he knew where Paris, which kingdom he was from, Troy. So he collects a big army, you know, all his entire army is mobilized, and all the people are forced, even the farmers, everybody. And they, so many huge ships are filled with warriors, and they go and they attack Troy. And Troy was very powerful, was well defended, and they tried for months and years, and they couldn't. And he wouldn't leave, you know, I have to get my wife back, no matter. It became an issue of, you know, and Paris and Helen, they loved each other, so she wasn't ready to go either. So finally he realizes that the smaller kingdoms are helping Troy, and that's why they are not able to defeat Troy. So what he does, he attacks each kingdom separately, each island, and he destroys and plunders and pillages and totally finishes the islands and kills the men and rapes the women and takes them to Greece, and children are killed and all that. And one by one, all the islands are destroyed. Why? Just so he can get that one woman. He kills thousands of people, get killed on his own soldiers and the other soldiers. Then finally Troy is left alone. But Troy was so well defended. The fort was so powerful, they throw shells and bombs and whatever those weapons they had at that time. May not be shells, but, you know, stones and, you know, nothing could break it. So 10 years passed, You know, and in this process, how many people, how much suffering was caused just for that one girl? Finally, they come upon a plan. And what they do is they build a, the Troy had a fort. Outside the fort, they built a giant wooden horse at night. They built it very secretly. They brought all the material, built it on the ship and rolled it. It was on wheels, huge horse, several stories high. And they put it on there. And then they got in the boats and took off. So the Trojans, the people of Troy, said, what happened? They left. Oh, maybe they gave up. You know, they couldn't defeat us. So they were very happy. And then they see this huge wooden horse. They say it must be a sign from the gods. You know, gods have sent us this horse. So they rolled the horse into the fort. They opened the gates of the fort. They thought the Greeks have left. A couple of them said, wait a minute, this could be a trick. They said, no, those guys are gone. And so they wheeled the horse, huge horse, into the fort. And that night they were celebrating and partying and drinking because they had won. And all, even the guards and the soldiers, everybody was drunk. But in that horse were hiding the selected warriors of the Greeks, very chosen men. So in the middle of the night, when all the Trojans were drunk and sleeping, they came out of that, you know, and slowly came down the legs of the horse, and they opened the gates of the fort, and the ships came back. You know, the Greeks had not gone far away. And so they attacked, and at night they killed every man, you know, of Troy that they could, and finally they got Helen back. So the point is that that's what attachment will do to you. You know, you don't care how many people are suffering, but I must have the object of my... And same thing, Paris, look at it also, you know, to get, keep that girl, how many people, you know, underwent suffering, you know, on both sides. So that is, that was when I was thinking of an example of attachment. While devotion or love for God brings peace and happiness, because my mind is full of love, full of compassion, full of sharing, a true devotee is content with whatever the Lord gives him. He puts all his best effort, does whatever he can, but his main goal is to serve others and help others. And at the end of the day, Lord, whatever you have given me, I deserve. I am happy. I am contented. So his heart is constantly full of peace and happiness. And obviously, attachment creates dissatisfaction, because at the end of the day, a worldly object never can give you permanent happiness. Will end in dissatisfaction. Is that all it is? You know, that kind of feeling comes. And a true devotee has eternal joy. Complete eternal joy. Because his joy is not dependent on a temporary object. Because objects in the world are changing. You and I are changing. Our house is changing. Our car is changing. Our neighbors are changing, our spouse is changing, our children are changing. If you depend on your children for happiness, or it will always change. But the one that is not changing, the more you hold on to him, the more you have eternal, constant, permanent, perfect joy. The ego increases. We had talked about that a couple of weeks ago. What is ego? I also have a CD on that if anybody is interested, which talks about how the ego grows, how the ego is that which separates me. Because I have these two beings. One is this lower being that I think myself to be, this limited body, anil and man and, you know, this and that. Or there is the higher being, the self, which is my true nature. So I more and more get attached to my ego, to my lower nature, and my actions become lower, while the true devotee of the Lord develops universal vision, sharing, giving, and seeing the oneness, seeing that there is only one God and everything is his creation. He may have different names, and he has equal love for all prophets, equal love for all religious books. Of course, he will read his own scripture and learn it and know it, but he respects all the world's scriptures, he respects all the world's prophets, all the spiritual homes and the churches, and he will never think of harming a place of worship. Some people think that if I destroy a building belonging to another faith, my God will be happy. That can never be. You know, you can never develop happiness by hurting somebody just because of their religion. And attachment is I plus I want. I this ego, when I get this, I want it, then only I'll become complete. Otherwise, I am incomplete. So attachment leads to incompleteness, where I feel that I am somehow not complete, not good enough, but by getting or acquiring, I'll become complete and perfect, while a true devotee, out of completeness, the person may be poor, may be a beggar, but when he has become one with that universal truth, then his whole life becomes giving. And maybe the person cannot give money, but the person gives knowledge, whatever he has learnt in his meditation or in his reading or from his guru or from the Lord himself. So he becomes a source of knowledge, shares his love with all, shares his vision of truth with everybody, helps everybody, becomes, you know, a true servant of the Lord. So this is very, very beautiful. Some of it has been covered in the text, and some of it, as I was reading, I got some thoughts. So this kind of makes it very clear, and that's why it says, a true devotee of the Lord, one who wants good, does not chase after attachment, but pursues a love for God. It's a very inspiring subject, and I'm sure there will be comments on that. Well, I think you have to develop love for God, where he becomes the primary, you know, your primary goal. But attachment can happen if you get attached to a particular form or a particular way and think this alone is right. But when you see the God as the universal, even though I love a particular form, I love Jesus or Krishna, there's nothing wrong with loving a particular form of God. Because it's only through the form that you can reach the formless. It becomes very difficult to see God as formless, all-pervading. But if I get attached to a form, then through that form I can reach the formless. So, but if to think that that alone is right, that is where it becomes attachment. But if I truly love God, then it is not an attachment or a dependence. It is unswerving, total love, unconditional love. There's a difference between attachment and love, because it is of the nature of giving. You know, the Lord who has given me so much, how can I help? How can I serve you? How can I? And that love is very uplifting. It does not bring you down. Attachment brings you down. But when you truly love God, your mind is uplifted. But one should have love for God, and one should have a relationship with God, definitely. Total, unswerving, ananya, where they say that alone, nothing else is as important as that. That one has to develop. Otherwise, you won't progress. It's like a person who wants to become good in computers. Every day they sit in front of the computer and they work. A computer becomes their number one goal in life, if that's their livelihood, or a person wanting to win the Olympics. 8-10 years, you know, that becomes his goal. So same way, spirituality has to become my number one priority in life. But I don't think it will attach you or bind you. In fact, it will free you. True love for God makes you free, because you see everything as him.
What do you pray to if you're not using a symbol?
Symbols, like say your son has gone away. You know, daughter has moved to Boston or New York. And so when you see the picture, it reminds you. You know, it doesn't bring you your child with you, but it reminds you, oh, my child, how much I love him. So symbols are a reminder of that who is not close to us. At this moment, we don't feel that we know this all-pervading, all. So when you go within, then you realize that there is one divinity, one all-powerful entity, which is represented in that form. And if some people can love the form and through the form reach the formless. But if your mind is that subtle that you don't need the form, and if you can see God in all the beings and everybody, then some people can see that, okay, I see God in everybody, so I serve everybody. Or some people need a particular form because it is easy to love. The way to realize, if you want to see him within, then what one should do is that constantly remember that my of every action is because of the presence of that divinity within me. So that God that is in the church or temple or that symbol is also within me as life, as consciousness. Another thing that I was going to talk about today in meditation is that the way to transfer that within is that every day take one attribute of that formless, which is also the form. Say, like you say, God is all pervading everywhere, or God is eternal. God was there in the past, present, and future. God is formless. God is, you know, cannot be thought. So instead of saying God is formless or God is consciousness, what you translate is that consciousness is me. That divinity is me. You know, instead of saying I am consciousness, because then that I becomes the little ego. But when you say that consciousness, that all-pervading consciousness is me, or that formless God is me. I am not separate from that formless God. That all-pervading consciousness is me. That eternal, I am eternal. That eternal being I am. And recently I have started doing that in my meditation, that I am eternal. That eternal being I am. I always was, I always am, and I always will be. I was there even before the sun and the moon were created. And I am here now, and even after the sun and the moon are gone, I will remain. I means not Anil, not this little individual, but I, that consciousness. So, in your meditation, spend 5 minutes or so, after you have quietened your mind, after you have done your, observed your breath, chanted your mantra, and, you know, relaxed your body, then your mind is quiet. Then what do you do in that silence? You plant this little seed. I am. Who am I? And every day pick one attribute. If you read our books of Vedanta, there are so many attributes. He is unthinkable. He cannot be thought of. Avyaktam. He is unmanifest. He is all-pervading. He is eternal. He is permanent. He is unchanging. He is indestructible. He is the nature of light. He is the knower of all. He is the substratum of all. So these pointers, there are at least 20 or 30 that are described in the book. So you pick each one every day, and for 5 minutes, just turn your attention and say, that I am, that unthinkable entity I am. And spend 5 minutes in that. That all-pervading being I am. That consciousness I am. That. So that's how you transfer that within. And then you take the form and go beyond the form to the formless, that is my true nature. And that is a very, very, it's like you are planting little seeds. You have cleared the ground. See, your ground was full of weeds and dirt. So you have cleared the weeds. You have made the ground clean and beautiful. You clear your mind of all the agitations and disturb. Now, what do I do with that fertile ground? I plant the seed of right understanding. Just as when I have cleared all the dirt in my garden, then I plant beautiful flowers. When I've cleared all the weeds, so similarly, when you have quietened your mind early in the morning, then you plant the seeds of who I am. And say, that consciousness I am, that being I am, that, you know, all these different qualities of that formless. And that's how you go within, and that's how your meditation will progress faster, and your vasanas will be burnt. If you want to burn your vasanas, that is the fastest way, by planting the seeds of that eternal being. So there was a lady who visited us this weekend, Vimalji, his sister. She's actually even more knowledgeable than he is. She has studied so much. So I was talking to her at quite much length and quite much detail. And so she kind of gave me these ideas. So I thought I would share them with you all.
If you say I am that consciousness, but you intend it to mean that it's the
spirit, know, right?
Spirit, not the,
true,
ego,
true. Right. But when you say soham, what does soham mean? He is me. It's not I am that. The correct meaning of soham is so that is me. Huh? Yeah. You are saying it right. You know, you use soham. That is me. Sa means that. Aham means me. So that is me. So it is just a better way of expressing it. Because when you say, I am that, it still can generate some ego, even though you understand it as the consciousness, that's very clear. But it is just a better way of expressing it. So the correct I was going to tell you, the correct translation of soham is, that I am. So that's how you progress in your meditation, from just quietening the mind to truly meditating. Because lot of places when you go and study, they will teach you how to quieten the mind through breathing, through chanting the mantra, through doing various yoga exercises, yoga, you know, this and that. But then what do you do with the quiet mind? Only the Vedanta will tell you that. What are the seeds you plant in that quiet mind?